It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi guys, welcome to part three of the Menendez brothers. I hope that you have found the last two parts interesting, and obviously this is the final one in the trilogy. I've never done a trilogy before. It has been a deep dive beyond belief. Let's kick off with today's part three of the Menendez brothers. Now, bear in mind, the cost of the first trial was extremely high, and by this point, the Menendez estate had actually run out of money. Now, Abramson, very, very fairly, I would say, and very ethically, continued to represent Eric. They were now funded by the state, and they took a significant wage reduction. Why? Because they believed Eric. It's as simple as that. And that speaks volumes to me. Now, Abramson was assisted by Barry Levin. Lyle, at this point, qualified for representation by the Public Defender's Office. Now, Lansing no longer represented Lyle, and they were actually replaced by Charles Gessler. And Charles Gessler is a Los Angeles County public defender who was considered the dean of the death penalty bar. And this would actually be Gessler's last case before retiring. Gessler was assisted by public defender Terry Towery. But I think it's really challenging, isn't it, when all of this information has gone ahead in a trial and then suddenly you have a new person representing you and all these new limitations. That must have been incredibly scary for both of the brothers. We get to the second trial beginning on the 21st of August 1995. This is when jury selection began. 11th of October 1995, opening statements began. Now again, the trial wasn't publicised because they said that if it was, it would increase the risk that the jurors would be exposed to information and commentary about the case outside the courtroom. And that means that there's a lot less information available about this particular case, because bear in mind the other one was on court TV, which made it very easy for me. Now, Weisberg also, aside from all the other limitations, limited the number of witnesses. Now that, in particular, affected the defence's case. How convenient that Weisberg decided, oh, we're not going to let you have a choice of how to convict them. We're just going to go for murder in the first degree. We're not going to let you take into consideration anything that happened in the background. No, no, that's not happening. And now we're not going to let you bring in lots of your witnesses. I mean, one could suggest that this particular judge was under the control of other people's suggestions regarding the outcome of this trial, couldn't they? Now, in the retrial, 64 witnesses testified, and that was comparing to 101 in the first trial. So that's a big shift. That retrial lasted 23 weeks. In the opening statements, Conn argued that the Menendez brothers were motivated by greed when they then ambushed their parents. The jurors were showed the autopsy and crime scene photographs, said the brothers were carrying their dead parents safe to the home of a probate attorney 24 hours after murdering their parents. So basically what they're doing is saying, oh, here we are, I've got my parents in my arms dead, let's get the cash. Obviously that didn't actually happen, but that's the image that he's trying to conjure. They were just straight there getting the cash just 24 hours after killing their parents. So their main basis was they argued the brothers are trying to get the hands on the parents' money as fast as they could. Now, Abramson, who, as we know, was on this case from the get-go, said the brothers killed them out of mind-numbing, adrenaline-pumping fear. Basically, that the parents were going to kill them for threatening to expose the family's secrets. They said, we will prove to you that Eric was tortured, terrorised, exploited, molested and abused to such a state that he lived in a constant state of fear. Gessler told the jurors that the brothers absolutely believed their parents had almost supernatural powers and knew literally everything about their son's activities. They argued that the prosecution's theory about money was wrong because both Lyle and Eric thought that their parents had disowned them, so that they didn't think there would be any financial incentive to kill. Now, the prosecution's case, well, of course, the tapes. We know those tapes exist. So Khan begins the prosecution's case by playing three tapes. The first tape that Khan played was of the brothers being interviewed by the members of the Beverly Hills Police Department. That interview actually took place 1 month after the murders. And the brothers are actually heard saying that they hadn't had any problems with the parents and discussing the activities on the day of the murders. Khan then played the tape of the brothers admitting to Oziel that they killed the parents. And then the last tape, which is very powerful, was that of Lyle's 911 call to Beverly Hills Police Department on the 20th of August 1989. Told the jury that the brothers had spun a web of lies after the killings and turned to tears to avoid suspicion. Now, that's very powerful, but I'm just going to deconstruct it for a minute because, of course, the boys are acting like they are victims because they're hoping that people won't suspect that they've murdered their parents. They're not going to say, hey, we've been horribly molested by our parents, because that's going to make them an immediate suspect. So the fact that they're being interviewed by the police a month later and going, oh, we had a great relationship with our parents, is to deflect from any suspicion that they are the perpetrators. So it goes hand in hand that they're going to make that up. They're not going to deride their parents in that way at that time because they don't want to be in the line of fire but being considered. So just because they've acted in that way in that moment means nothing. Likewise, when they blew the brains out of each of their parents and they made the 911 call, the suggestion that they might not be upset is also wrong. It is quite possible to kill somebody and still feel a level of upset. And that would be verified and validated by the very fact that in the end, it's too much for one of the brothers initially, and they actually confide in a therapist, and then the other brother comes and does the same, because that shows an emotional component of a level of empathy, a level of guilt, and all the things that go with it, which takes them outside of the obvious bracket of being some kind of stone cold psychopath. So again, even though the prosecution has got a very compelling case, you can deconstruct that pretty simply when you look at what I've just said. Now, in the second week of the trial, the prosecution go ahead and present evidence to support this theory they've got that the brothers are motivated by greed. Clara Wright is the wife of a probate attorney that the brothers had retained. They testified that the brothers brought a safe to their home because they wanted to find a copy of their parents' will inside. She hadn't actually testified in the first trial because the prosecution didn't actually know about the safe at the time. Now, that safe was opened 2 days after the murders when Brian Anderson and Carlos Baralt, who are the brothers' uncles, could be present, and apparently the safe was empty. Now, Carlos Baralt testified that 2 months before the murders, Jose had indeed said he wanted to disinherit his sons. Khan then asked him if he knew of any evidence that Jose sexually abused his sons. Carlos answered no. That means jack all. So what? Like, that means nothing. It's so ludicrous. We're like, do you know whether Jose was sexually molesting his children? I mean, if he says yes, that makes him absolutely not right, doesn't it? That makes him absolutely culpable for allowing this kind of abuse to play. Of course he didn't know, or if he did know, he wasn't going to say it in court because it'd make him look terrible. So that's absolutely no testament to truth or what was happening. Now, on cross-examination, Baralt was actually asked by Abramson why Jose had talked about disinheriting his sons. And he said Jose was disappointed that Lyle was failing academically at Princeton. In Jose's opinion, Eric also lacked toughness and forcefulness. Then disinherit them. I mean, you've brought them onto this earth. They haven't become exactly as you wanted. So why not make sure that their life is more challenging by totally disinheriting them? That is such a weird approach. And that, again, is evidence of Jose's character. So he is a tough person to be around. The prosecution also brought in private pathologist Robert Lawrence, who was basically called to support the prosecution's new theory of the crime scene. So the prosecution believed that Lyle and Eric murdered their parents and then shot them in the leg in order to make the killings look like a mafia hit. So on the witness stand, Lawrence actually used wooden mannequins pierced with wooden rods to illustrate the crime and also to show the angles of the shotgun blasts. Now, Lawrence testified that Jose was hit 4 times and Kitty was hit 9 times with shotgun blasts, said they were shot in the head and the extremities, but not shot in their torsos. Said Jose was seated on the sofa when he was shot and that the wound to his thigh was inflicted after he died. Also, that the fatal shot was fired at point-blank range to the back of his head. Now, most of the shots to Kitty, they occurred apparently when she was lying on the floor. Some of the gunshot wounds to Kitty's arms, hands and shoulder indicated that she might actually have been cowering at the time, which is horrific. It's awful to imagine that she died that way. Abramson, at this point, tries to show the blood patterns on Jose's shirt, saying that it indicates the shots might not have been fired in the direction Lawrence claimed they were, because there were disputing theories about whether the parents were sat or stood up at the time of being shot. Now, Dr. Erwin Golden, this is a person, bear in mind, all the way at the beginning of this video when I was talking about the autopsies, they performed the original autopsy on Jose and Kitty. But it's told in court that they're not going to testify. So even though he testified at the first trial, and at that point, bear in mind, could not say for certain how many shots were fired, or indeed the sequence of the shots that killed them. So this is the person who originally did it. In 1995, Golden was really criticised for mistakes that he'd made in the autopsies on Nicola Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. Bear in mind, that was in the O.J. Simpson case. So the prosecution didn't call him. Instead, they called, I would say, who they believe is going to be their absolute star witness as far as ballistics are concerned. So they called Dr. Roger McCarthy. Now, Dr. Roger McCarthy reconstructs the shootings. This Dr. McCarthy, even though he was not involved originally, he determines the sequence of the shots and testified that the murders were premeditated and deliberate. Now, I don't know whether this guy's a psychic, but I mean, that's impossible. Genuinely, it's impossible. Back in the day when this is being done, it's impossible. But anyway, he reconstructs the murder shots by shot. He shows the jury a computer-generated recreation of the murders. He said that the brothers went into the den, surprised the parents. The parents were just sitting there watching TV in the den, just going about the business. And that apparently Jose and Kitty are sat side by side on the sofa. This is when they're attacked. That the brothers aimed kneecapping shots at their parents to make the murders look like a mafia hit. Now, bear in mind, the brothers maintained throughout the trial that their parents were standing when the shooting began. And it's really strange to me that some guy gets brought in and makes out that they know what happened in that moment. I mean, it's BS. Again, I'm not coming down on the side of who's right, who's wrong regarding the motivations behind why these men killed their parents. I am saying, you can do one with that theory. You don't know the sequence of shots. You don't know where they were standing. But the people who actually killed them said they were stood up and they were there. And the fact that the parents were standing doesn't mean that they killed them less. They still killed them. Now, Gessler questioned McCarthy about, firstly, his qualifications to examine the Menendez murder scene. And at this point, McCarthy admits, firstly, oh, yes, my qualifications were... got a few issues. I haven't actually ever visited a crime scene. I've never actually witnessed an autopsy. Also, I kid you not, said, never seen the impact of a gunshot wound on a human body. Indeed, conceded, he did not consult with a coroner or criminologist before reaching his conclusions about the Menendez brothers. Sorry, what did you do? I just made it up. Why? I just think I should be able to. But you've done it on a computer analysis. Yes, I've imagined that that would happen if I was just, you know, looking at this scene in a way that means that these boys are guilty. So I thought I'd just go ahead and do it. Have you any experience in this field? I have literally none. Have you ever seen a dead body? Absolutely not. That sounds terrible. Have you seen anything to do with gunshot wounds, impacts and how things can play out? Yeah, not at all. Not at all. Well, I've watched films and I've just tried to recreate that right now. I kid you not, that happened. We get to the 20th of November. At this point, Con rests the prosecution's case against the brothers. He called 30 witnesses. The foundation of his case was McCarthy's computer-generated reconstruction of the murders. How is this possible? And yet, it was. So Con used this reconstruction to basically demonstrate to the jurors that the brothers had deliberately, methodically killed their parents. Now, bear in mind, this is strongly disputed by the defence. Also, completely contradicted by the brothers' testimony. They said they fired their shotguns in a blind panic. And bear in mind, windows had been taken out, etc. So it does sound like these were not schooled individuals who knew how to go about executing their family. It was overkill. It does not defend what they did. They still killed their parents. If they're saying their parents were stood up, it's strongly likely that they were, as opposed to some guy who's never seen a dead body, never actually been involved with anything to do with guns, not been at an autopsy, etc., and doesn't really know anything about it. But hey, let's just say that this is verbatim truth. Now, when it came down to the defence's case, who obviously wants to contradict this, they brought in Martin Fackler, who was an expert on wound ballistics. Now, Fackler testified that McCarthy's reconstruction, firstly, could not be considered scientific. Secondly, it contained a hell of a lot of errors. Also said, literally, no one on God's earth could design a reconstruction of the Menendez crime scene because there are far too many variables. Now, Conn cross-examined Fackler, and again, with respect, he demonstrated that he didn't know the facts of the Menendez case as well. So he and McCarthy were actually useless. It's bizarre. Now, during Abramson's redirect examination of Fackler, he told the jury about the defence's latest theory about what had happened in August 1989. This is how they played out the events. Said the brothers had entered the den where Jose and Kitty were standing in front of the sofa facing them. Eric then shot randomly at his parents. Lyle was to Eric's right and also began firing his shotgun as he walked around the room. Lyle fired the gunshot to Jose's head. Abramson didn't actually describe Kitty's shooting, but did say she was standing as the shots were fired. So that's how they portray the events. Now, the assistant director of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department's crime lab did not agree with McCarthy's conclusions and actually testified that his blood splatter analysis actually contradicted much of McCarthy's reconstruction. So his analysis showed that Jose and Kitty must have been standing at some point during the shootings, which corroborates what the young men who were responsible for their murders said. At the first trial, they also brought in Dwight Van Horn, who actually was a prosecution witness about the type of shotguns that had been used in the killing. However, now they bring in Van Horn as a defence witness. And the reason for this is because Van Horn said McCarthy's reconstruction was, quote, junk science because it ignored evidence in some instances and lacked it in others. So basically wrote it off. Now, Conn, of course, attacks Van Horn, says he resented the prosecutors using McCarthy's firm instead of the Sheriff's Department for the crime scene reconstruction. I mean, this is BS, isn't it? Like, you're not going to go in and be like, oh yeah, I'm going to dispute this case and make out that you've got it wrong because I'm angry you didn't use my department. Come on, it's like child's play. And we're talking about something really important. We're talking about the prosecution of two men who may have been victims, even though they also are responsible for the killing of their parents. Now, a well-respected pathologist from Pennsylvania, Dr. Cyril Wetch, said any reconstruction of the shootings was doomed to failure because the victims and the defendants were all moving during the killings. Charles Morton was brought in, said blood patterns and bullet holes in Jose and Kitty's clothing, again, contradicted the prosecution's reconstruction of the crime scene. Morton said the physical evidence at the crime scene indicated Kitty was standing when she was shot. Also, testified that the blood patterns on and around the sofa in the den and on Jose's clothes indicated that he had been shot while standing, except the shot to the back of the head. So again, substantiating what the Menendez brothers said. On the 6th of December, Eric began the first of 15 days of testimony. And testimony began much like it did in the first trials. So he described the awful incidences of sexual abuse that had been inflicted on him by his father. Under questioning by Barry Levine, Eric testified that his parents were violent, that Kitty humiliated and degraded him, that Jose beat and molested him. Eric said, I love my parents. I didn't kill them out of hatred. I didn't kill them because of money. I killed them because of the abuse. I was scared that they were going to kill me. And I wanted to reveal the abuse. And I knew there'd be consequences to that. During the third day of testimony, Judge Weisberg limited Eric's testimony about early childhood abuse. What does that say to you? That says that Judge Weisberg was sitting there going, I don't like this. This is a bit convincing. This guy's getting really upset. This guy's coming across as somebody who might actually have been abused. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to limit the amount of stuff he can say about it. I mean, it's bent. I'm sorry, guys. It's bent. Come what may, the evidence should be given and the jury should make a decision based on that. But this judge has done everything in their power to prevent that happening. Like I said, what needs to come out in court is truth. But Judge Weisberg is bent as a nine bob piece, as my late father would have said. And he stops him talking about that early childhood abuse. Also, the judge rejected some stories the defense wanted to introduce as irrelevant, because this judge obviously thinks they're God. Also limited testimony that had what they said was little to do with the brother's state of mind at the time of the killings. Now, the defense were arguing that the brother's early childhood trauma was basically critical for the jury to hear, because then they could understand why the brothers thought that killing their parents was the only way, because their parents, they believe, were plotting to kill them. Now, Eric said that Jose had told him he'd been written out of the will. He said, you're not living up to my expectations, you're not getting any cash. Also, gave testimony about the circumstances leading up to the tape confession at Azeel's office. So, talking about what had got to that point where he needed to speak about it. Con comes in to cross-examine. And basically, the job of that prosecutor is to make the jury look at Eric as a manipulative liar. And they did a pretty effective job, I would say. So said that the lead up to his arrest, Eric was lying to the police, to his family, to his friends about the murders. He attacked Eric's claims that his father was still sexually abusing Eric when he was 18. He said, you've got a car, you've got money, you could have left your parents' home. Again, just simplifying the trajectory of impact regarding abuse. I mean, anybody who's been abused knows it doesn't work that way. Also, Con asked Eric, why don't you just join the army? I don't know. Well, I don't want to kill people. I'm not that brave. You know, I wouldn't join the army. Being abused doesn't make you go, well, maybe I should go and join the army. I mean, it takes a very courageous individual to do that. But these are the kind of questions being posed. And Eric actually said, listen, the army wouldn't have protected me from my dad. Jose was the most powerful man I've ever met. Again, playing into that tyrannical dominion that he felt his father had over him. He did concede that there were absolutely no living witnesses to the sexual abuse. Why should he? Nobody should have to say, well, you need to see this sexual abuse happening to me for it to actually be real. It's not fair. It's not the way it works. Con, of course, then naturally raised the issue of Eric's sexual orientation because he wanted to show that it was a source of tension within the family. I mean, how dare they say that being gay would be something that should be brought into that context in a way to substantiate that you would want to kill your parents just because of your sexuality. Also, though, what's the problem with being gay? And again, that just evidences that Jose was not very kind when his son was struggling potentially with his sexuality and not accepting of his son. On the 9th of January 1996, Eric's completed his testimony. At this point, he's attempted to explain questions raised by the prosecution over 8 days of examination. He said he and Lyle did not make up the stories of child abuse to avoid murder convictions. They just tried to tell the truth once it had come to light that they'd been arrested and to explain the motivations behind why they had killed their parents. Now, Dr. John Wilson, who is a psychology professor from Cleveland State University, he testified that as far as he was concerned, in all his professional acumen and understanding, Eric suffered from PTSD at the time he killed his parents. He said, as far as he was concerned, this was caused by repeated acts of sexual, physical, and psychological abuse at the hands of his parents. Dr. Wilson said Eric suffered from the classic symptoms of PTSD, so nightmares, gaps in memory, flashbacks, etc. He said that this was the first time that jurors had actually heard a specific diagnosis applied to Eric Menendez. At this point, there's a change in the defense strategy. So on the 12th of January 1996, Gessler changes Lyle's defense entirely. So he tells the court that he planned to argue Lyle had killed his parents in the heat of passion, overwhelmed by anger and fear, rather than genuine fear for his life. Now, the reason for this change in tactic was that Lyle didn't want to testify again. And this was particularly down to damaging impeachment evidence the prosecution had gathered since the first trial. Now, Lyle was better received than Eric in the first trial. He was seen as a more sympathetic witness. However, prosecutors had managed to record phone conversations between Lyle and Norma Novelli. That was a friend of Lyle's and a confidant of Lyle's. And he described how he snowed the jury with his testimony about abuse. And the prosecution had also found a letter that Lyle had written to an ex-girlfriend instructing her on how to testify, which looks very bad. Now, because Lyle didn't testify, his lawyers could not call child abuse experts to testify about his state of mind. And without that, Lyle could not use the same defence as he did in the first trial. Now, towards the end of the trial, the judge ruled that six witnesses who had testified in the first trial were now irrelevant to the second trial, and they would not be allowed to testify. Ruled that Jose and Kitty's psychological mistreatment of the Menendez brothers was irrelevant. I mean, please God, somebody help me out here. The judge ruled that the psychological mistreatment of the brothers was irrelevant. Irrelevant! I mean, we know so much more, don't we, these are coercive control. We know that people can be domineering and make people's lives a misery, even without raising a hand to them. And they can act in violence towards that perpetrator in the end. We know that. But back then, no. Your psychological mistreatment's irrelevant. That shouldn't have any contributing factors to the way that you act in the moment. The defence were also limited to one mental health expert, which is ludicrous. Because different mental health experts have different scholastic achievements. So a psychiatrist is different to a psychologist. A therapist is different to a psychologist. There are different paradigms of profession. They were also not allowed to present the testimony of Dr. William Vickery from the first trial, because he had actually continued to treat Eric since 1990. So Gessler relied almost entirely on Abramson's witnesses and basically called few on Lyle's behalf. And that meant that the jury knew very, very little about Lyle's involvement or background, which is really destabilizing, clearly, in this case. On the 30th of January, after presenting 25 witnesses, the defense rested its case. Then there's a prosecution rebuttal. Eric's psychological examination, because Eric had tendered his mental state as part of his defence. So Judge Weisberg ruled he had to do a psychological examination. We all know how these go. This was conducted by Dr. Dietz, who had, by the way, testified in numerous high-profile trials. And what can I say? Some could say that this doctor's a little bit biased in favour of the prosecution. Let's just say he'd assisted quite a lot of prosecutors in winning convictions in significant cases, such as Jeffrey Dahmer. We're all glad that he managed to do that one. Betty Broderick. So this is somebody who's got form. He interviewed Eric for 16 hours at the Beverly Hills Police Department, and he testified, surprisingly, that Eric did not suffer from any disorder that would impair his ability to make rational decisions on the night he murdered his parents. So he's like, no, it's all rubbish, all that stuff that all those experts said, no, it's all rubbish. All he's got is a little bit of, you know, generalized anxiety disorder. He also said, this is something that takes my breath away because it's just ludicrous and you need not to qualification in anything to be able to see this. He said it was impossible to diagnose Eric with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, because he had no way of knowing if the alleged events were true. I mean, literally, can somebody please come in with a sledgehammer and just destroy this man's qualifications and credibility? How on earth can this person be like, well, I'm sorry, you can't be diagnosed with PTSD. Why? You haven't got any direct evidence of what happened to you. No, I'm telling you that, you know, it happened 15 years ago. It was awful. Yes, and I'm saying I wasn't there 15 years ago. So therefore, I can't say it happened. No, I think that you're just meant to hear what I'm saying and accept that what I'm saying is something that's affected me. And I'm having all of these flashbacks and nightmares and traumas. And I'm saying to you, unless I was there, it did not happen. That's ludicrous. But anyway, says that's not true. Also rejects the other conclusions presented by all the defense experts, saying he doesn't suffer from learned helplessness. which is another PTSD symptom. Also points out that Eric bought 2 shotguns, loaded his weapons and went to the shooting range to learn how to fire a shotgun. Again, that's a loose connector. A lot of people in America like to go to the shooting range and like to figure out how to fire a shotgun. Actually, I'd like to fire a shotgun. I'm vegetarian. I don't want to kill anything or anyone, but I'd love to shoot a shotgun. You know, I wouldn't mind doing it. Answers on a postcard if you know a local place to me that I can go and do that with. I'll absolutely oblige. He said that the behaviour showed rebelliousness and assertiveness that is inconsistent with passiveness of learned helplessness. So guys, you can't be helpless in certain situations and actually successful in others. In fact, we should just all accept, shouldn't we, that anybody with psychological trauma should be rendered absolutely incompatible with doing anything at all. You're just basically a lump on the floor who can do nothing. It's bloody ridiculous. So it's really not going well now, as far as the jury are concerned, listening to this information for Eric or Lyle. And also, whilst not allowed to testify as he had in the first trial, Judge Weisberg did actually allow Dr. Vickery to testify as a rebuttal witness about Eric's anxiety disorders. But Vickery's testimony was apparently nowhere near as effective as it had been in the first trial. But again, that's probably to do with the fact that the witnesses that are being brought in are speaking as a statement of fact, as opposed to assumption. We all make assumptions. It's subjective. The fact that this person has been there for the prosecution is on their side and is saying there's no PTSD unless we've actually seen you go through something, that's ludicrous. But if somebody is strong in their suggestions saying that, then it's very easy to take that verbatim. Anybody who watched the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial, certainly not something I would cover on this channel, but I will tell you now, the clinical psychologist for Depp was absolutely faultless, and the individuals they brought in for Heard, they were awful, and it makes a big difference. Now, another witness that they brought in was Lyle's ex-girlfriend. Now, she testified that Eric did know that Lyle wore a toupee as early as 1988. So again, that's trying to discredit this whole idea that he was stunned when mother ripped it from his head and his brother saw it and he was humiliated and that connected them closely. She's saying, no. They definitely knew about it at this point. So again, that's destabilizing. Now, on the 20th of February, Conn began the first of 4 days of closing arguments and just used a belittling and sarcastic tone throughout, ridiculed the abuse claims as the, quote, silliest, most ridiculous story ever told in a courtroom. Now, listen, I don't know about what actually happened, but let me tell you, when I saw those young men falling apart in court, I at no point thought that they were acting. And I am a really suspicious person. I've worked for many years in therapy with people who are in emotional pain, and I found it very difficult because it's painful. I feel it. So to say it's the silliest, most ridiculous story ever told in a courtroom, you've not done a lot of cases, because bear in mind, there's a lot of people spinning yarns that are far more ludicrous than these young men saying that they were abused and that's what led to the killings. And I don't like undermining the emotional component because it is very hard to watch. So basically attacked Eric's testimony, said it was self-serving, that it was filled with lies, it was filled with inconsistencies, and urged the jurors to find them both guilty of first degree murder. Of course, that's the way that they went. But like I said, I just don't think the belittling of the historic sexual abuse that, to my understanding, seems to have a valid place in their defense should have been allowed. But this is how it works in these situations. Bear in mind, it's all about winning. It's not actually about truth often. Now, on the 26th of February began the first of 3 days of closing arguments where Abramson was concerned. They accused Conn of basically presenting fraudulent witnesses. And the reason for that is they wanted to win the case for political reasons. Well, just going to throw in, I think the judge was on side with that as well. Pointed out that the Los Angeles County DA's office was under a lot of pressure to win a big case because they'd lost the first Menendez trial. And then, of course, they had lost the O.J. Simpson trial. They argued that the crime scene indicated the killings were a highly emotional overkill. They weren't premeditated. They weren't made to look like a mafia hit. Basically, it was emotionally charged and they hadn't got a clue what to do, which is why the scene looked like that. They said that Eric had PTSD, did not harbour malice at the time of the murders, and shot down essentially the prosecution's idea that they killed for financial gain, and actually said, listen, the historical reality of parricide is that it doesn't tend to happen for money. Now, I will note that parricide has happened for financial gain before, but certainly this is what the defence was pushing, that parricide wasn't actually about financial gain. It was indeed about dealing with people who are potentially tyrannical or abusive. Like I said, research plays out that there are different reasons for it, and sometimes it is true that people do kill for money. Now, Gessler, I would say his argument was somewhat less convincing or grandiose than Conn's or Abramson's. They attacked the prosecution's arguments, essentially. They asked the jury to find Lyle not guilty of murdering Kitty and guilty only of manslaughter in Jose's death. Now, this particular defence was basically comparing the Menendez case to a Greek tragedy. When it came down to the deliberation, the 1st of March, the deliberations began. On the 14th of March, Judge Weisberg actually was forced to remove two female jurors, including the fourth person, for actual medical reasons. So the fourth person suffered a heart attack, and another juror actually went into premature labour. One male and one female alternative juror were then brought in to replace them, which is a little bit challenging because it means that the jury deliberations have to start from the beginning again. The second jury consisted of 8 men and 4 women, so immediately we were brought into the reality of what happened in the first trial, where the women were sympathetic and empathetic to the Menendez brothers. At this point, they are outnumbered because there are 8 men and only 4 women. After 4 days of deliberation on the 20th of March, they came back with a verdict, and the verdict was that the Menendez brothers were each guilty of 2 counts of first degree murder, as well as conspiracy to commit murder. They also found that there were 2 special circumstances, which was the lying in wait and also multiple murder. So this meant there were only 2 sentencing options, and that was life in prison without the possibility of parole, or indeed death by execution. And this would be decided in another trial by the same jury. The penalty phase, that began the 22nd of March 1996. It lasted 3 weeks. The rules of evidence were actually different in the penalty phase than at the trial, because the jurors at this point are making a life or death decision. So the defence is now allowed, finally, to appeal essentially to the jury's sympathy. So they were allowed to offer defence of mitigating factors, so their ages, whether they were under extreme mental or emotional distress, anything that can mitigate the actions to a degree. So on the 4th of April, which is the second week of the penalty phase, this is when the trial basically took a really controversial turn. Dr. Vickery admitted he doctored his notes at Abramson's direction, which is terrible, isn't it, at the penalty phase. So under cross-examination, he admitted he'd left out entire sections of his notes, which contained incriminating statements made by Eric Menendez. So on the 4th of April, unbelievably, Abramson invoked her Fifth Amendment rights, and that meant that she wouldn't incriminate herself when asked 2 questions about her misconduct. But you can imagine, this is the worst thing that could possibly happen. Now, Conn said that in 1993, Abramson gave him the redacted version of Vickery's notes. Now, bear in mind, disclosure is meant to be full, so that's really bad. And at some point in the trial, Conn had needed to review the notes whilst at the Van Nuys courthouse, but had basically left his copy in the office. So then he borrowed a copy from Dr. Dietz, who for some reason had been given a copy of the original notes by the defence, and found that Vickery had deleted 24 pages of statements that Eric had made, and they had rewritten 10 pages. Now, on one of those pages, Eric had told Vickery he thought about what it would be like to live without his parents. In another section, he said that he and Lila discussed doing something drastic. Now, the notes didn't actually specify what that meant, but clearly that's a bit incriminating. Eric had also told Vickery that Jose's male mistress, he asked, does the word mistress still apply if it's a man, had visited the house 2 days before the murders and told the brothers their parents were going to kill them. But Vickery later admitted that Eric told him that that story was actually a lie. So this is really destabilizing. Now, the defence argued that at this point there should be a mistrial for both brothers due to Abramson's ineffective assistance, but Weisberg ruled that Lyle could not make that argument because Abramson was not his lawyer and that Barry Levine was perfectly capable of taking over Eric's case if necessary. So it's a hot mess. It's as simple as that. It's a hot mess. And also, I don't think it's bad that their brothers are saying things like, we've thought about doing something extreme, or we'd like to get away, or, you know, even idealizing this possibility of not being around their parents anymore. You know, that is something that is quite normal. It's typical. People talk about those things. It doesn't mean they're actually going to go ahead and premeditate killing, but nonetheless, it looks really bad. Now, there were 2 days of closed door hearings at this point, in which Gessler and Levine tried to have Abramson removed. Eric spoke to the judge himself, and the reason that Eric spoke to the judge is they wanted to advocate for Abramson. So on the 9th of April, Weisberg ruled a conflict did not exist between Abramson and Eric that would necessitate her removal from the trial. So the jury at this point was instructed to not consider Abramson's alleged misconduct when deciding on the death penalty. Although, with respect, if you're on the jury, that's going to make everything that's said in defense by that person be very questionable. Even if it was all correct, aside from what I've just discussed, aside from the things that weren't handed over to the prosecution, it's gonna look bad. Now, the judge also ruled that the prosecution couldn't ask Dr. Vickery about Abramson's direction to delete the notes, instead directed the prosecutors to impeach Vickery's testimony without making any references to Abramson. Apparently, from that point on, Abramson, because she invoked the amendment, remained silent for the rest of the trial. The following day, Vickery actually concluded his testimony, and the prosecution presented 3 other witnesses. That was Les Zola and Kitty's 2 brothers, Milton and Brian Anderson. When it came down to the closing argument, Conn argued, of course, that the Menendez brothers should be sentenced to death. They said, listen, these guys killed their parents in this horrifying, brutal, premeditated way, went ahead again, ridiculed the defense, ridiculed the allegations of psychological abuse, and said, look, these are desperate and trivial defenses. They're not real, they've lied, and you should find them guilty in the most aggressive way and have them put to death. Levine accused their Los Angeles DA's office of arbitrarily deciding who was eligible for the death penalty. So reminded the jury of the O.J. Simpson case and said, he's not even eligible for the death penalty. So trying again to say, look, what these guys did was terrible, but they shouldn't be put to death. And also said the prosecution has not presented the evidence of aggravating circumstances other than the crime itself. So it's got to be life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. So the deliberation and ultimately the verdict happened after 3 days of jury deliberation. At this point, they do decide on life in prison as opposed to the death penalty. The jury later said that the abuse defense was actually never really a factor in the deliberations. They said that the reason that they didn't want to put them to death was because even though what they'd done was heinous as far as they were concerned, neither of them had ever had a previous criminal record, although apparently they burgled neighbours, but we'll put that aside for the moment. Also, they hadn't had a history of violence. Most of the jurors said they were really sympathetic to the brothers' upbringing, but they felt that that did not excuse their crime. Now, unlike in the first trial, the jurors in the retrial said there was literally never any division in the group. So none of them apparently believed the defense when they said that the brothers killed because they were in fear of their lives, nor apparently did they believe that they murdered their parents solely for their money. But essentially, they felt that they had killed them without needing to kill them. The jury basically thought that the boys were not really at threat of being murdered and therefore could have acted completely differently. Now, before the sentencing took place, Eric and Lyle's defense lawyers actually filed a motion seeking another trial, said that Judge Weisberg should not have refused to allow the jury to consider manslaughter victims. So basically claimed that he should have allowed the jurors to have heard the tape from the 11th of December, 1989. This is when the brothers actually confessed to the now disgraced Dr. Azeel. Also stated that Judge Weisberg should not have limited the number of defense witnesses who testified about the Menendez's upbringing, which I think is absolutely correct. Before their sentencing, Lyle and Eric actually went ahead and gave an interview to Barbara Walters, the infamous, very famous, very well-known Barbara Walters, for their TV programme 2020. At this point, they basically said, please let us be imprisoned together. And I understand that, of course. Prison's going to be awful for anybody, but if you could spend it at least with somebody that you love, it would make it more palatable. On the 2nd of July 1996, we get to the sentencing. Weisberg sentenced Lyle and Eric to life in prison without parole. They were at this point taken to North Kern State Prison. So this is just outside LA. That was for a diagnostic evaluation. It was also about a decision on whether they would be allowed to remain in the same prison. At this point, Lyle was 28 and Eric was 26 by the actual time they were sentenced. On the 10th of September, 1996, the Menendez brothers were separated. Lyle was taken to the California Correctional Institution near Tehachapi, and Eric was taken to the California State Prison near Sacramento. Apparently, at this point, they were segregated from other prisoners. They were classed as maximum security inmates. Abramson, who'd obviously represented one of the brothers, said that the move was just unduly cruel and punitive. But Zoella said he was pleased that the brothers were apart. He said, I think that them being together means everybody's at risk. So essentially, why keep two people who have been found guilty of first-degree murder together just because it's nicer for them because they're related? Now, Lyle was then moved to Mule Creek State Prison. He stayed there until 2018. He actually served as president of inmate government there. Eric was incarcerated in actually a few different prisons. So Folsom State Prison and Pleasant Valley State Prison. I bet it's not pleasant, by the way. Eric was ultimately moved to the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility. That's in San Diego County. It's about 500 miles away from Lyle. But they kept in contact. Clearly, their relationship was really important to them. And they would write as often as they could. They'd actually been banned, bizarrely, from talking on the phone, which I just think is so inhumane, it's unbelievable. But they did write letters to each other. They played chess by sending their moves through the post. So they're very, very, very loyal to one another. They said that their separation was just incredibly painful. Eric actually went on a hunger strike when they were separated. I mean, it didn't work because he's still here. He didn't starve to death. And it didn't have an impact. But it shows you how devastated they were. Now, on the 27th of February, 1998, the California Court of Appeals upheld Lyle and Eric's murder convictions and said no new precedents had been found. Also, they said that Judge Weisberg had not made any mistakes in limiting their defense testimony, even though to anybody with an ounce of intelligence, you can see it really wasn't fair. On the 28th of May, 1998, the California Supreme Court voted to uphold their murder convictions and life without parole sentences. Now, none of the Supreme Court justices voted to review the case. At this point, both brothers filed habeas corpus petitions with the Supreme Court. They were then denied in 1999. And that meant that they'd basically exhausted their appeals in state court. So at this point, Lyle and Eric filed separate habeas corpus petitions to the United States District Court. On the 4th of March 2003, those petitions were denied. Then they appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. On the 7th of September 2005, three-judge panel denied both petitions. Although Judge Alex Kaczynski, they noted that Judge Weisberg changed many of his rulings during the two trials, which is absolutely true. On the 2nd of July 1996, interestingly, Lyle married Anna Erickson. Apparently the ceremony was attended by Abramson, also his aunt, Marta Menendez, which interests me because, you know, a lot of people wouldn't support people who'd murdered their parents. That was officiated by Judge Nancy Brown. The couple, in spite of that, divorced on the 1st of April 2001 because Anna found out that Lyle was cheating on her with another woman. I don't know how that works. I don't know how it works, guys. I mean, I don't know how you have an affair when you're locked up, but I imagine it was a very emotional one, shall we say. But anyway, November 2003, Lyle married Rebecca Sneed at a ceremony in the visiting area of Mule Creek State Prison. Apparently, they'd known each other for about 10 years before they got engaged. Lyle was actually still in prison. That means when they met, but nonetheless, they fell in love. In 2017, Lyle said, I have a very steady, involved marriage, and that helps sustain me, brings me a lot of peace and joy. It's a counter to the unpredictable, very stressful environment here. And hey, People deserve love, right? Even when they've done unspeakably bad things. Now, Eric, on the 12th of June 1999, married Tammy Ruth Sackerman at Folsom State Prison. Got married in a prison waiting room. Tammy later said, our wedding cake was a Twinkie. We improvised. It was a wonderful ceremony until I had to leave. That was a very lonely night. But both of them have obviously got relationships. In fact, in 2005, Tammy self-published a book. They said we'd never make it. My life with Eric Menendez. She said in an interview with Larry King that Eric did a lot of editing on the book, so obviously was dual in that. It wasn't as if she wrote it without his permission. And then in October 2005, Tammy gave an interview describing her relationship essentially with Eric and said, it's something that I have dreamed about for a long time, and it's just something very special that I never thought that I would have. She said that she and her daughter drove 150 miles every weekend to visit Eric. So clearly has a deeply invested relationship there, albeit one that can't necessarily take on the usual experiences of couples. Now in February 2018, a pretty monumental thing happened. Lyle's security level was lowered and he was moved from Mule Creek State Prison to the Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility. Now that prison houses 3,900 male inmates. Lyle and Eric were now both there. Now, they were initially kept in separate units, so they weren't actually able to interact with each other, but it must have been amazing to know that your brother was local. And then on the 4th of April 2018, Lyle was moved into the same unit as Eric. Apparently, they burst into tears immediately when they were reunited. And the unit that they're actually housed in, it's basically reserved for inmates who agree to participate in education and rehabilitation programs, and they're the kind of people who don't create disruptions. And that is actually notable about both of the brothers. They haven't been disruptive during their time incarcerated. Also, in June 2024, Lyle got a sociology degree through the University of California, which is Irvine's special college program for inmates at Richard J. Donovan Correctional Facility. So obviously spending time as wisely as possible. And Lyle has stated that whilst he was in prison, one of the things that's really helped is just the hundreds of letters from other people who suffered child sexual abuse, that these people connect with him and relate to him, and it really helps. He said, prisoners were coming to me with their own stories because they saw me as a safe place to sort of vomit up all that pain. Lyle has literally devoted his life in prison to child sexual abuse survivors and has created a support group in prison. Now, none of us are defending killing your parents, but it's also important to note how they have moved forward with their lives. Now, in 2018, Lyle and Eric, along with the prison, they actually created the rehabilitation through beautification. And what this is basically creating green spaces. So it's a way of making prison reform feel like the place that you're living in is more livable. It's painting murals on walls. It's planting more trees. It's just making it feel less corporate and institutional, I suppose more home-like. Their idea is to transform prison yards from oppressive concrete slabs into like normalized park-like campuses with outside classrooms, group meeting spaces. It also aimed to create a service dog program for wounded veterans and also for people suffering with PTSD and autism. So a lot of really progressive ideas coming from them. Now, there have been some recent case updates, and I'm sure a lot of you know about the Menendez brothers because of all of the stuff in the media that's been on them recently. So in May 2023, the brothers requested a new hearing. This is based upon new evidence that's come to light. Why? Because a screenshot on Instagram was posted of a letter written by Eric to his cousin, Andy Cano, in which he alludes to serious and long-term abuse at the hands of his father. This letter was written 8 months before Jose and Kitty were killed. It reads, I've been trying to avoid Dad. It's still happening, Andy, but it's worse for me now. I can't explain it. He's so overweight that I just can't stand to see him. I never know when it's going to happen, and it's driving me crazy. Every night, I stay up thinking he might come in. He's warned me 100 times about telling anyone, especially Lyle. Am I a serious wimpus? I don't know. I'll make it through this. I can't handle it, Andy. I need to stop thinking about it. 8 months before their parents were killed. Now, Andy died in 2003, but had testified that Eric had told him about his father's abuse when he was 13, and Andy's mother found the letter 9 years ago. That was included in the 2023 petition to examine whether the brothers were indeed unlawfully imprisoned. So defence attorney Cliff Gardner absolutely understandably said, if that letter had been introduced to the jury during that 1996 trial, it may well have changed their minds on the final verdict. They said, given today's very different understanding of the devastating impact of sexual and physical abuse on young children, the testimony about Jose's sexual abuse of Lyle, that was excluded at the second trial, and the remarkable new evidence, we think resentencing is in the interest of justice. And another abuse allegation happened. So Roy Rosello, who is actually a former member of the band Menudo, claimed Jose molested him as a teenager when he was head of RCA Records in the 1980s. So it's not just the boys who are talking about the abuse, it's somebody unrelated. And Roy said that when he was 14, Jose drugged him and raped him during a trip to the Menendez family home in New Jersey, which is horrifying because we're talking about a pattern of abuse now. Now, on the 4th of October 2024, at this point, it's announced that Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon is reviewing new evidence pertaining to the Menendez case. So it might mean there is a different outcome for these men for the rest of their lives, such as freedom. Now, Kim Kardashian, would you believe? She's also helped put the Menendez case back in the spotlight. She does a hell of a lot when it comes down to innocence work and proving that miscarriages of justice have occurred. And obviously with a profile like Kim Kardashian, when she sheds light on something, it's illuminated for everybody to see. She went ahead, she published a personal essay. This was with NBC News, and it was urging for Lyle and Eric's freedom from prison. She actually mentions visiting the brothers in prison, and she says that one of the wardens said that he'd feel absolutely comfortable having them as neighbours. Now, 24 family members, 24 guys, this is including Kitty's siblings, have literally released statements fully supporting Lyle and Eric. They've actually requested the justice system freedom, which I think is just really powerful, with respect, because if somebody murdered my family, I certainly wouldn't want them to be free. What does it tell you about the personality of Jose and Kitty if actual members of their family believe that the boys, who are now men, should be freed? Now, one of the things that some of you might have seen recently is a TV dramatization of the case, and that was released on Netflix earlier this month. It's called Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. In my opinion, it's horrific. It's really distasteful. It's a terrible take on the case. And Murphy, who created it, said that they've never actually met or spoke with the brothers. I do believe that one of the actors has. He said that even though he found Eric's testimony interesting and that, quote, the show is the best thing that has happened to the Menendez brothers in 30 years, apparently, what actually happens is the show depicts the brothers having some kind of incestuous relationship. How disrespectful. It's just not true. How did Netflix get to do this? I mean, they do it quite a lot. They'll say this is a true story, and it's just not a true story. The Menendez family have actually said the show is literally riddled with mistruths and also outright falsehoods, and it's just somebody cashing in on this situation. Now, there is a potential resentencing. So as of the 17th of October, 2024, DA Judge Gascon has said that he hopes to make a decision very quickly as to whether to recommend resentencing for the Menendez brothers. If he does, it is possible they could be out of prison by the end of the year. In fact, by the time this video comes out, they may have had that decision taken. And he added, if in fact they have been rehabilitated, as we are being told, which is what we are reviewing, then I don't believe they should spend the rest of their life in prison. They've already been in prison for 35 years. A lot of people will disagree with that. A lot of people will say double homicide, spend the rest of your life in prison. No one should have empathy with it. But like I said, there's a lot of support for these men. The DA's office, they're going to present their resentencing decision to the LA Superior Court by the 26th of November 2024, so really soon. Since 2021, the resentencing units have reviewed or are currently reviewing 681 cases. So far, 300 people have actually been resentenced. 206 of those were immediately released from prison. So the question is, will the Menendez brothers get to live out the rest of their days with their wives freely? It'll be interesting, and I will definitely add to the description below when I myself find out. It has been a mammoth case, an absolute mammoth case. Thank you so much for staying with me during it. I hope that you have found out some information that you might not have known. As I said, I think the documentaries that have come out recently have been really interesting to watch. I think that series, Monsters, was just absolutely awful because I just think it tells a completely fabricated story about the Menendez brothers. And whatever conclusions are come to, I do think that there is something very powerful about the family members wanting them free. And it is amazing when somebody like Kim Kardashian comes out and illuminates these kind of cases, because people just take notice. And people can say whatever they want about the Kardashians. When somebody like Kim Kardashian is actually going out of her way to do good work, then I think that's something that should be absolutely applauded without a shadow of a doubt. Let me know your thoughts in the comments, guys. I appreciate that this has been a long one. That's why I've divided it into two. And I would be so interested to know your comments. Just jumping on, guys, because I recorded the video a week ago and a lot happens in a week. And indeed it has done. So the DA has agreed with the idea of clemency for the brothers. There is supposedly and potentially going to be a release date given. And it looks like after 30 odd years of them being in prison for the, yes, horrifically brutal murders of their parents. So deservedly they should have gone to prison for a period of time. But this period of time, it seems, is definitely going to come to an end relatively soon. Some of you will feel upset about that. Some of you will feel at peace with that. Some of you will potentially be on the fence right now. Personally, do they pose a risk to society? I don't think so. Secondly, do I think that they were horrifically abused and mistreated? Absolutely. And most importantly, do I think that the American justice system in this case was, shall we say, on the bent side? You bet your bottom dollar. See you again next time. Hope you found them interesting. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.